welcome to the Libertarian Podcast from the Hoover Institution. I'm your host, Troy Senek, and the Libertarian is Professor Richard Epstein, the Peter and Kirsten Bedford Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, the Lawrence A. Tisch Professor of Law at NYU, and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, grappling with the coronavirus. And Richard, unfortunate, though perhaps not surprising, that we have to return to this topic a few weeks after we first addressed it on the show. I want to start today with the economic dimensions of this. The market has been in turmoil as you've had more cases show up in the United States. Trading actually had to be suspended for a bit on Monday. It's been up and down since then. But you've also got these concentrated industry effects, right? Big downturns for the airlines, for cruise ships, one assumes probably for rail as well. If we get more restrictions on public gatherings or even just more voluntary adoption of what's being called social distancing, you can imagine the revenue hits for movie theaters, hotels, restaurants, sports, theater, et cetera. And you can imagine a scenario in which those dominoes start falling pretty quickly. Obviously, the priors of most libertarians militate against subsidies and bailouts in most situations. When we're in act of God territory like this, does that position change or weaken at all?
Well, it's very clear that the traditional rule of no penalties, no subsidies clearly changes. But the issue is exactly what you're supposed to do with all this information and how much good it could do. Let's just start with one sort of simple observation. There are basically two kinds of industries that are involved in these cases, and you have very different responses. So if you have a slowdown in production of durable goods now because people are afraid to come to work, you can make that up somewhere down the road. But on the other hand, the moment you start losing things like today's transportation, vacation trips, and so forth, there's no making that up tomorrow. You can't stockpile those kinds of goods. And so when you cancel an event and you say you're going to reschedule it, if you reschedule it, then some other event is not going to take place because of the burden. So these are huge and immediate losses. The question is there any way to sort of deal with the distribution of these losses, which is give rise to your subsidy question? And the true answer is they are so utterly pervasive, so completely unpredictable, so erratic, and there's so many of them coming forward so fast, you would not know whom to tax in order to find out somebody to whom you could subsidize. Just little old me sitting in my room sort of watched the dominoes fall with an enormous change between Monday night on the one hand, where I spoke at a public event, and Tuesday morning when everything started to get canceled. I had to cancel two events at the law school, a conference, a trip to Washington. I think there were eight cancellations involved in the course of 24 hours, and it wasn't as though I thought anybody had made a mistake with respect to any of them. Now, some of these events will be rescheduled, but that means, as I said before, others are going to be pushed out. So there's that. Then the question is the government able to really do anything on these kinds of cases? I think, in effect, that certain kinds of crowd control might be appropriate, banning certain places. I'm not trying to say that the government is going to be immobile, but I think the single most conspicuous feature about this situation is that the dominant responses have come from two sources. One is you start seeing individual responses. So my wife and I ventured to a museum today, and there are a substantial number of people who are wearing latex gloves as they sort of walked around the place. I noticed that all the sandwiches were wrapped. Nobody seemed to keep anything out. There were Purell cans everywhere around the place. People kept their distance from one another. And I think that this kind of stuff makes perfectly good sense. There's no way you could stop it, no way you would want to stop it. And it may well put a brake on some of the spreading, assuming that it is a risk that's going to happen. And then there are the institutional responses. Well, I'm associated with three universities, all of which are on some kind of various lockdown procedures. Stanford's more or less shut down. The University of Chicago is thinking about remote classes. NYU has introduced remote classes already. We've had elaborate bulletins about what kind of checks should be had, whether staff can work from home. And these are just absolutely tumultuous. I don't know what the financial consequences of this are, but it's quite clear that all these private institutions move much more rapidly than the government. Then the question is, well, what should the government do under these circumstances? I know the president has been criticized for not being sufficiently worried about all of this. I don't know whether the same charge should be made against me. I don't know what the severity of this is, but I'm just going to give some numbers. I mean, if you talk about the typical flu season, you're talking about between 20,000 and 50,000 deaths in the United States, and nobody shuts down everything. If you're looking at the situation with the coronavirus, the death total is still under 50 in the United States. Cases are multiplying, and it's quite clear that this stuff is probably more deadly than the standard flu virus and could hit a wider spectrum of the population. There is, however, a huge debate that I do not know the first thing about as to the rate at which this thing can spread. I at least saw one prominent epidemiologist said it's ferocious and it's fast, and I saw another account saying it's ferocious and it's slow. Which of these two is correct essentially is going to determine the success or failure of all of these kinds of ventures. My own view is that, generally speaking, really virulent things tend to burn out more quickly because what happens is they kill people who get them before they can spread it to somebody else, and less serious things tend to go on a little bit longer but with less disastrous consequences. So I think the odds are, at least from background probabilities, that you're talking about this on the lower rather than the higher side. But even if you're doing that, what are people supposed to do? And how do you calibrate? Suppose somebody were to tell you, in all honesty, that if we do nothing about the coronavirus, we're going to lose 50 to 75,000 people dead. And then they say, if we do something about it, we're going to. And that's where you don't know how to fill in the blanks. Exactly what collective actions that you can have that would reduce this thing in some sensible way. So what makes this so extremely difficult is that you give a large degree of discretion to public figures. And I have no doubt that that's correct. We give an enormous amount of discretion to our employers. And I think they've really done rather admirably. We give it to individual people. For the most part, I think they behave very sensibly. I hear all sorts of stories about people self-quarantining themselves. And then I hear the occasional story about some sick person getting on the plane because he doesn't want to be caught away from home, spreading the virus to others. I think that's the lower risk. I think the other things are more competent. My hope is that this thing will top out and be a bit more effective. And the irony is, if it does top out, as one earnestly prays it will, you don't know whether it's because of the inherent properties of the virus or the nature of the effective precautions or some indeterminate combination of the two.
I want to have you react to an interesting argument that was made yesterday, I believe, by Bill Galston in the Wall Street Journal. He had a column entitled "Efficiency Isn't the Only Economic Virtue."
And
his argument there, for our audience's benefit, was essentially this, that so many of the hallmarks of a modern economy, these just-in-time delivery systems, for example, are built on wringing all the slack out of the system, getting everything as precise as possible, eliminating redundancy. But because everything has to go just right for those systems to work, that makes them vulnerable to unanticipated events like this one. So we've heard this argument, for instance, before about the reliance on medical supplies from China. And let me just read briefly a quote from Galston. He says, "Resilience in the face of unexpected shocks is a public good, and experience is confirming what economic theory predicts. In the relentless quest for increased efficiency, which remains a key source of competitive advantage, the decisions made by individual market actors will produce, in the aggregate, a less than optimal supply of resiliency, a public good. To solve this collective action problem, government must act as a counterweight," close quote. Now, he does go on to stipulate all the ways the government could screw this up. But what do you make of this argument? The systems that are so crucial to our economy during normal times are unique vulnerabilities in a crisis like this.
I think he's wrong on the facts. I mean, if you're trying to talk about efficiency, what you have to do is you have to do it in all states of the world. And it is quite clear that if, in fact, you have good times, what you want to do is to have no redundancy, or to give the parallel with respect to the way systems are worked, you could have a system work in series, or you could have it work in parallel. And in series, it's like a railroad track, and you just put each link and you go further, further in the distance. And it turns out that if everything's fine and you take your 100 tracks and you extend them the full length, you go further. But everybody knows about the downside, and then you get redundancy. So it may well be that you want two tracks of 50 because they will perform better in bad times. That will to offset the gains in good time. And if you start looking at the way private businesses do this, they do not, I think, behave in the way in which he suggests. So, you know, you're a company and you're worried about a strike from UPS. What you do is you in advance put together a background contract with FedExpress that they will take some of that stuff. If you're somebody who's shipping goods overseas, what you do is you make absolutely sure that you've got two carriers who can handle that stuff. If you're a bank, turns out that you managed to keep at least two sets of records, one in the home office and one in the back office and so forth. If you're Richard Epstein and you're working on your computer, you have the university back it up behind you so that if you lose your machine or if the data gets wiped out, it can be reduced in other circumstances. I think the answer is defining efficiency incorrectly. If essentially you say optimality only in good times, systems have to be robust and they have to deal with that. Now, the key question in many cases is, can you find a way in which you could expand the operations in good times and still keep the backup in bad times so that you can make these phase states very rapidly? That's hard to do. If you can do it, it's the best of all possible worlds. But I don't believe that anybody believes that, in effect, the only thing you want to do is to get stuff out. Now, he also mentioned that article another thing, which is, I think, was about almonds. He said you want to concentrate them all in a given region. And again, it's exactly the same problem. You concentrate anything in any given region without having any backup and supply. And if there's a bug or a blight that hits, it all goes out. And so for the longest period of time, people have understood that. And so if you start looking at the way farms were organized in medieval time, what happens is, people had strips of land which were located in different parts of a village. And the reason why they separated them, even though it was harder for them to be operated, is that if something started to go down in one part of the town, you still had strips in another part of town so that you would not scrape bottom. And generally speaking, when you're in societies which turn out to be pretty close to the survival line and adversity will kill you, you see a lot of redundancy built into those particular systems. When you things get a little bit better, then you don't have to do it. And the other thing, of course, that you do is not only do you allocate the strips in that particular fashion, but these same societies have a second background, which is a sharing norm that takes place if somebody gets wiped out. Everybody else kind of chips in. And that's one of the advantages of having close ethnic communities where they're more willing to do this. The Korean bodegas or whatever they're called are, I think, something in that particular range and so forth. So I think he's pointing to a problem, but I think there's also a solution. And then, in effect, it is a quote, public issue, what is the government supposed to do? It means in good times, you have to tell everybody how to run their business. You can't do this. You have to have that kind of background or the other thing. I think it's awfully difficult to start to do that. I think the most important thing is for people like Galston and everybody else to write these articles so that people remember what's going on. But I'd be very surprised if you looked at major corporations that they essentially have a one-and-done strategy with respect to all of their key elements. Redundancy is an essential feature of efficiency. It's not something that is opposed to it. Redundancy is a firm virtue as well as a public virtue. So I think the case for government intervention is relatively weak.
What do you make of some of the stimulus proposals that the virus has engendered? So you've had the Trump administration flirting with the idea of doing a payroll tax cut. Jason Furman, who was the head of the Council of Economic Advisors in the Obama administration, wrote a piece in the Wall Street Journal saying that we should give $1,000 to every American and an additional $500 for every child. Are those measures that are well tailored to the economic challenges that we're up against right now?
No, I can't conceive of how it is that this is going to work. I mean, huge numbers of people have been wiped out. If you're going to give this kind of money, you're going to have to finance it somehow. If you do it by immediate taxation, it's just another burden on the overall system. If you try to do it in terms of long-term financing and so forth, you have to ask yourself whether or not having the public vote alone is better than getting local banks to give some kinds of assistance to various people. If you recall, that was also what was done by George Bush in 2008 when he had the individual grants to various kinds of people, and it did absolutely no effect whatsoever on this stimulus. The technical problem is pretty simple. What you do is you have an exogenous source of money come in, and the naive theory that people have is that people are just going to spend it on current expenditures in order to, quote, stimulate the economy. When they looked at it previously, that's not what happened. Some people have standing debt. So they used some of this money to pay it off. Some people decided they had to save for college, and this would be an opportunity to save for college. So when you get these funny monies coming in, it's just not at all clear exactly whether it's going to go to savings, debt reduction, current expenditures, the purchase of long-term capital goods. And remember, we don't know how long this thing is going to last. And the longer it lasts, obviously, the greater the distress and the dissociation with it. But I think, in effect, what you really try to do is to figure out how to control the disease and to encourage people to take private mitigation devices, collective advices through their employers and their workplaces and their churches and whatever else that they have to do, and that that would be much more efficient. The transfer payment has with it no efficiency properties that I can see.
So last question that I'll ask you, Richard. We are recording this the day after Bernie Sanders took another drubbing in the Democratic primary. So it's looking increasingly like the push for Medicare for All is going to diminish in the short term. Hard to imagine, however, that we've seen the last of that. That seems to be the direction that the left is going in. If we were living today with a healthcare system more to Bernie Sanders' liking, single-payer healthcare, serious restrictions on drug pricing, how would that affect our ability to react to a pandemic like this?
It would be a disaster. Because of the point that you earlier mentioned, governments are very slow afoot. And if you start looking at the way in which these systems work, they do two things. One is they kill all private initiative, because he's not just talking about, I think, government insurance. I think he wants to basically nationalize and socialize the whole system, at least in some of his version. One of my Hoover colleagues, Scott Atlas, presented a very nice paper at a conference we did on simple rules. And even if you allow for all the massive imperfections that we have in our current missed system, the one thing that we know in the United States is that access to health care, queues are shorter in every major capacity here than they are overseas. What happens is all these things are under budgeted, and so the only way you could ration is by making people wait in line, often when they're dealing with very serious situations. Private systems are much more nimble in the way in which they work and much more capable of making adjustments. I'm just thinking again of all the employer notices that I've gotten and my family have gotten and everybody else has gotten, and I can't think of a single employer or institution that I've been associated with which hasn't been working on this thing full time. And the general logic of decentralized control and crisis outperforming centralized lethargic control by some socialist dictator named Bernie Sanders and his cronies, I don't think it's even close. I'll make it very clear. I've never heard a man in public life who is as systematically, willfully ignorant as he is. And I think that the Democrats pulling away from him is a welcome feature. My real worry about the Democrats and Joe Biden is that in response to Sanders, they're going to be more progressive than they ought to be. This is a case in which decentralized private responses of the sort that we're having are more likely than anything else to make the best of what has turns out to be a very bad situation.
All right. Thank you, Richard. And thank you to our listeners. Remember, you can read Richard's column, The Libertarian, at Defining Ideas at Hoover.org. And you can follow him on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. And if you enjoyed the podcast, please rate it on iTunes. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Sinek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution, where we advance ideas that define a free society. For more information about our work, and to hear more of our podcasts or see our video content, please visit hoover.org.